In our study of Romans, we've come to chapter 4, and I'm going to read the first 12 verses. This is picking up the pace significantly from the last couple of weeks when we only covered maybe 6 or 7 verses. My plan is to cover the first 12 verses anyway, but we'll read them. Chapter 4, verse 1. What then shall we say that Abraham our father has found according to the flesh? For if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does the Scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. Now, to him who works, the wages are not counted as grace, but as debt. But to him who does not work, but believes on him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is accounted for righteousness. Just as David also describes the blessedness of the man to whom God imputes righteousness apart from works. Blessed are those whose lawless deeds are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord shall not impute sin. Does this blessedness then come upon the circumcised only, or upon the uncircumcised also? For we say that faith was accounted to Abraham for righteousness. How then was it accounted? While he was circumcised or uncircumcised? Not while circumcised, but while uncircumcised. And he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had, while still uncircumcised, that he might be the father of all those who believe, though they are uncircumcised, that righteousness might be imputed to them also. And the father of circumcision to those who not only are of the circumcision, but who also walk in the steps of the faith which our father Abraham had while still uncircumcised. Now, in some ways, one could argue that the transition here, the chapter beginning, is a little bit misleading. The Apostle Paul is really continuing what he began in verse 27 of the preceding chapter, in which he meditates further on this sharp contrast between justification by works and justification by faith. That contrast he's already developed several times earlier in the chapter. In fact, it's a list of verses I didn't put on the board here, but it probably averaged about every other verse in which he makes that contrast in the preceding chapter. And here he draws out the implications of that. What does it mean that justification is by faith and not by works? And how can we understand that further? One of the ways he developed that at the end, which we saw last week, was about boasting. In verse 27 of chapter 3, where is boasting? It is excluded. And just to see the tie-in between chapter 4 and chapter 3, what's the question that he asks about Abraham in verse 2? If Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about. Okay, not a question, but that's an assertion. You see, there's a parallel there about boasting. And he emphasizes here again that it's by faith and not by works. Verse 5, chapter 4, him who does not work but believes on him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is accounted for righteousness. And again, the parallel is shown between the end of chapter 3 and what we just read in the discussion of circumcision, right? In especially verse 30 is a reference to circumcision and uncircumcision, or the uncircumcised, and that, again, comes up in chapter 4. So you can see how the two portions are tied closely together. The important part of chapter 4 is the use of examples from the Old Testament. And examples is really too weak a word. I'll try to explain that in a minute. But you'll remember that Paul had already said at the beginning of this, in chapter 3, verse 21, in the beginning of his presentation of the gospel in a positive way, that the righteousness of God apart from the law is revealed, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. Okay, so here are two witnesses from the law and the prophets. One is Abraham, in whose account comes from Genesis, and then the other is David in Psalm 32. So you see, it's a confirmation of what he said before, or what he said at the very beginning of the book, that his gospel, in a sense, is not a new thing. It's something that the Scriptures testified to from the very beginning. And he wants to point especially to Abraham. Abraham is the main character in the chapter, although David does come up briefly. He wants to point to Abraham as confirming what he has been teaching. But even that is probably putting it in 2 weeks away. For us, we may tend to think of it that way. We read the scriptures and we say, well, there's this fellow Abraham, and, you know, there's guy Moses, and there's David. There are all these characters, and they were all justified by faith, and you can read in Hebrews 11 about the faith that all these characters showed. But Abraham is of great significance, far greater than significance than it might sound just from listing all the people. Abraham was their father, and Paul refers to that. He was their father according to the flesh, and references like Isaiah 51, 1-2 encourage the people of God to think of Abraham as their father. Look to Abraham. Look to the one whom God blessed and who is the father of your nation. So Paul is really taking up that and saying, okay, well, let's consider Abraham, who is surely the most significant figure in terms of the establishment of the nation, the line that came from him, ultimately, obviously through Isaac and Jacob, but led to the establishment of the Jewish people. And of course, that's true because Abraham was the recipient of the covenant that God made. And I'll try to review that when we get back to Genesis, but Abraham can be called the father of the faithful because he received the sign of circumcision, but the sign of circumcision was the sign of the covenant. So it's a significant example. It's not just some random example. And that's connected with one further point before we get started too much here, and that is that the Jews, especially the Jews of Paul's day, at least there's some evidence that a significant number of them, tended to look at Abraham as the model of a person who was accepted with God because of his righteousness. Okay? Now, it was this mixture of faith and righteousness that we've talked about, or faith and works that we've talked about before, but Abraham was especially pleaded as an example of a good law keeper, which from a certain point of view is correct. He was certainly commended after his willingness to offer Isaac. But in a sense, Paul is challenging them at the very core of their belief. He's saying, okay, you look to Abraham? Let's look at Abraham. What do the scriptures say about Abraham? He's the one you look to as the model for acceptance with God. Well, how was he accepted with God? What is it that the scriptures say about that? So I wanted to preface the discussion with that because I don't want you to think of him, oh, you know, he could have picked any other character. It's true. As I said, Hebrews 11 gives us a long list of men of faith. But here there's a special significance in Abraham. He is our father according to the flesh. And really the question is ultimately, is he also our father according to the faith that he exercised? Do we walk in the steps of faith that he walked in? So that's the reason why Abraham is especially significant. Okay, and then the section that we're going to look at can be broken up into two pieces. Verse 1 is, I would say, introductory largely and sets the question. And then verses 2 through 8 focus on especially this question of justification by works versus justification by faith in terms of the accounting of righteousness to us. And then verses 9 through 12 talk about circumcision and uncircumcision. Okay, so that's where we're going. And the first thing he does in verse 2 is do a little logic with this. Okay, so you read the commentators and they set out these syllogisms. I'm not going to use words like that, but it's fairly easy to see what he's saying. He says, if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about. And then the but not before God is the but he doesn't have anything to boast about. Okay, so what's the conclusion? The conclusion is that he's not justified by works. Okay, that's the logic of it. If he were justified by works, he could have something to boast about, but in fact he doesn't have anything to boast about. And so his argument is, therefore, Abraham was not justified by works. Okay, why does he not have anything to boast about? Well, that Paul demonstrates by use of one verse from the Old Testament, Genesis 15:6, which he quotes in verse 3. Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. Now, this one verse, I'm going to argue, is taken completely in context in Genesis and fits exactly with what Paul is saying. And it's a favorite reference in this chapter. He also uses it in Galatians. But if nothing else, just look at the very end of the chapter, well, close to the end, verse 22. and therefore it was accounted to him for righteousness. Okay, he keeps referring to this verse over and over again in chapter 4 because it shows that Abraham, the exemplar of works on one model, is really the exemplar of faith and of acceptance with God because of righteousness imputed to him, received by faith. So let's think a little bit about that that verse then that he's going to use. And so we'll turn to Genesis 15. And here's where I'm especially liable to spend a lot of time talking about the context, and maybe it's unnecessary. I'll try to be relatively brief here, but let's at least read Genesis 15 in context. Verse 6 is what Paul quotes, but I'll begin the reading at verse 1. After these things, has reference to the battle that Abraham fought in successfully. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward." But Abram said, "Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus?" Then Abram said, "Look, you have given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir." And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "This one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir." Then he brought him outside and said, "Look now toward heaven and count the stars if you are able to number them." And he said to him, "So shall your descendants be." And he believed in the Lord. He accounted it to him for righteousness. And the passage goes on from there to talk specifically about the question of the heir, and then especially to focus on this this awesome, this mysterious ceremony in which this burning lamp passes between the pieces of the dead animals. It's a covenant initiation ceremony. But you see, at the end there, verse 6, he believed in the Lord and he accounted it to him for righteousness. Now, what was the content of Abraham's faith? Well, certainly in the immediate context, it is the promise that his descendants would be multiplied. But you have to realize that this isn't the beginning of God's promises to Abraham. So if you, I'm going to try to cut it a little bit short. If you go back to chapter 12, remember the great promises that were given. We quoted these in Esther frequently, that God would multiply his seed, that in his seed all the nations of the earth would be blessed. And that was really a rehearsal of the promise given in the garden, that the seed of the woman would come. And so when Abraham believes in the Lord, he's not merely saying, "I'm going to have a bunch of kids." Okay, so that would be a great thing to believe, because he didn't have any. He didn't see any hope of any. But it was a hope in the Messiah. It was a hope in the covenant promises that God had given to him. And Paul, in essence, fills that out in Romans 4, because when he applies it to believers, he talks about faith in Christ. Okay, so there was more that the Romans knew about the Messiah than that Abraham knew about the Messiah, but it's the same basic faith. It's the same content. Okay? So this phrase, he believed in the Lord and he accounted it to him for righteousness. What does "accounted it to him" mean? Well, okay, again, I'm going to try to save old time here. I put up three references, Leviticus 7, 18, and so on. Maybe the third of them would be the most helpful. But there are parallel constructions in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew, to this, accounted it to him for righteousness, or at least accounting it to his credit in some sense. And in many occasions it has to do with crediting someone with something that isn't his, with reckoning something to someone, even though it doesn't belong to him. And in the case that I'll mention, the third of these references in 2 Samuel, Shimei. Remember, Shimei didn't behave himself very well when David was leaving, having to flee from Absalom, and turned out he was on the losing side. So, you know, David comes back in, and Shimei apologizes profusely. And he says, "Let not my Lord impute my iniquity to me," or "account my," it's the same word, "account my iniquity to me." Now, he was guilty, right? I mean, it was a pretty serious thing that he did. But he's saying, don't count against me the guilt that really is mine. Okay, so it's a negative form of this. But you see, the point is that it's something that rightly should have been counted against him, but he wanted to be credited with innocence, as it were. And that you can find positive references to that as opposed to not accrediting it, to me. But that use then in Genesis 15, you can find paralleled elsewhere. It has the idea of imputing, I'll come back to these words, imputing or crediting something to someone that doesn't actually belong to him. That is, in this case, it's a status of righteousness. And how does Abraham receive that status of righteousness? Well, it's not because he himself is personally righteous. It's because he believes and the Lord credits that righteousness to him. Okay. So the reason I'm going through this is just to stress that Paul is using this verse in context. Paul isn't just reaching into the Old Testament, finding the word impute and righteousness and then believe in the same verse and saying, ah, there we are. Yeah, that's what I want. You know, the Jewish contemporaries are wrong. No, he's using the verse perfectly consistently with the way the phrase is used elsewhere in the Old Testament, and especially in the context of Abraham, who looked to God, who believed the promises of God, and was through that received as righteous. It's an interesting fact, by the way, that this Genesis 15:6 is the first time that this verb believe appears in the Old Testament, and it's in connection with believing unto righteousness. Now, let's go back then to Romans 4. I hope I've convinced you that Paul isn't just plucking verses at random out of the Old Testament, but that in fact he's really going to the heart of Abraham's relationship with God. It is a righteousness received by faith. And so when he says Abraham has nothing to boast about before God, the reason he has nothing to boast about is that a righteousness was credited to him that wasn't his own. Okay? So there is no reason why he should be able to boast before God. It wasn't because of his own righteousness. It was something that was credited to him. Now, I've already used these words several times. If you have the New King James Version, you may notice that there are various words used, but it's actually they're all the same in the original. So verse 3, New King James, it was accounted to him for righteousness. Verse 4, wages are not counted as grace. So a similar word, but not exactly the same. Verse 6, the blessedness of the man to whom God imputes righteousness according to works. Those are all the same word in the original. And the ESV actually does a good job here, just helping us. It uses the word count, I think, for each of them. So it's the same word. And it can also be translated, as I've used it, credited or reckoned. And maybe just to help us see that, Paul uses what could be called an accounting metaphor in verse 4. What is it that's counted or not counted? Well, it's wages. Okay, so you think of having a ledger in which you record the wages that are due to someone. Okay, and that's the context here. So crediting has this aspect of reckoning. Okay, of giving some kind of a credit to someone. And as we've seen from the Old Testament, it may be regardless of whether they're owed that credit in a sense. Now, that would be some kind of fraud, I guess, Dave, wouldn't it? And isn't there some Sarbanes-Oxley that's probably in there somewhere? But it's okay for God to do it. So, but that's the sort of sense of the word. And I want to come back to this idea of imputation in a minute. But let's look at verses 4 and 5 and see what Paul does here. So he wants to explain further, again, to draw the contrast between justification by works and justification by faith. So he says, to him who works, the wages are not counted as grace, but as debt. Okay, so if you work and your employer has promised to pay you something, it's not out of the goodness of his heart that he pays you in the end. He owes it to you. There's an obligation. Okay, and that's the point that Paul is saying. It's not counted as grace, but as debt or as obligation. And then that's, you might say, the metaphor that he's using, but he doesn't quite make the transition. He gives the contrast and the application in verse 5 at the same time. But to him who does not work, and now he's thinking of the believer here, not using the workplace metaphor anymore. Well, he's using the language of it, but he for the concept, but he's applying it specifically to the believer, to the one who does not work but believes on him who justifies the ungodly. His faith is accounted for righteousness. So the same phrase as with Abraham, right? He's going to keep hammering that phrase home. Abraham believed God and it was accounted to him for righteousness. He's saying it's the same for everyone who believes on that justifying God. His faith is accounted as righteousness. Now, the point is then that when we stand in relationship to God, we don't look at the things we do as wages, as if we lay an obligation on God and he has to pay us. Okay, that's usually merit is a word that's used often in connection with that. Merit is a laying of some kind of obligation on God that he somehow owes us something. And he's saying here that that's not the case for the believer. The believer doesn't work. Okay? Paul isn't saying, you know, you sit around and be lazy or something like that. He's talking about, with respect to justification, the works do not enter in. Instead, it is faith. It is believing on the one who justifies the ungodly. And if we are in that situation, then just as Abraham found it, so we will. Our faith will be accounted for righteousness. Okay, now, David is the next, as I said, example, if you want to put it that way. He gives supplementary evidence, corroborating evidence with David in Psalm 32. But before I get to that, let me make a few applications. And sorry, I have four notes here. Okay, some of them are more technical than others, but I think it's important for us to think about what we just saw, because it's really packed. Okay, there's a lot in here, and there's a lot that has led to controversy, perhaps unnecessary controversy, but it has. And the first thing is, here's an idea that Paul really didn't bring up as much in chapter 3 that he's using to explain how we're right with God, and that's the idea of imputation or reckoning or accounting. It's the same thing. So our faith is accounted for righteousness. And that's really equivalent in Paul's mind to justification. You can see the parallel between verse 6, so we're skipping ahead a little bit, but the man to whom God imputes righteousness apart from works, and the reference to justifying in verse 5. So for Paul, in general in the New Testament, this justification is equivalent to imputing righteousness. Okay, it's the same thing. And the catechism definition gets to that point, right? Justification is because he imputes the righteousness of Christ to us. Now, Paul will explain that further elsewhere. He doesn't explain it much here. He's already referred to the righteousness of God in verse 22, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ. So he's already essentially said that the righteousness that's credited to us is not a human righteousness, but a divine righteousness. It's a righteousness from God. And if you look at the larger picture, you will see that it is the righteousness of Christ in particular that's credited to us. In other words, we're justified because Christ's righteousness is imputed to us, is accounted to us. That's what Paul is saying here. Okay? It's not our own righteousness, it's not our own works, it is the righteousness of another that's credited to us, just as it was in the case of Abraham. Now, how does that come to us? Why is it that it's credited to us? Well, Paul is saying here it's by faith. But as I said, if you read even further in Romans, he'll spell that out. And so someday, probably, we'll get to the last part of chapter 5, in which Paul sets out the two great heads, federal heads, that is covenant heads. So Adam and all those who are in him have death, and Christ and all those who are in him have life and righteousness. So sin and death in Adam, righteousness and life in Christ. And so the reason Christ's righteousness can be accounted to us is that we are in Christ, okay? Because he is our covenant head. Just as we died because of Adam and his sin is counted against us, so so the righteousness of Christ is counted to our credit. So that's coming. He's going to spell it out further, but I thought I would just remind you of that fact. So the accounting for righteousness, the crediting, is the righteousness of Christ, and it comes to us because we're joined to Him. And you might say it's not just a federal headship. No one likes the federal government these days. They can't agree with each other. But it's a good word. But it is by a vital union with Christ, so that we are joined to Christ. And again, Paul is going to say in the New Testament, because we are in Christ, all that we have is what we have in Him. All of His riches are ours. So that's something that will be worked out later. But I didn't want to pass this reference to accounting and justification and crediting without emphasizing that it's the righteousness of Christ credited to us. Okay, that was only the first point. Sorry. Okay, three more. Try to go over a little more quickly. If you read carefully what Paul is saying in Romans 4:2, and if you read what Moses is saying in Genesis 15:6, it seems to be the case that what is credited to us is our faith. Okay, what Abraham believed God, and it, his faith, was accounted to him for righteousness. And if you read the way Paul uses that language later on in Romans, you could get that impression. And some people have made the case that, in fact, the reason we're accepted before God as righteous is that God says, well, their deeds aren't actually righteous, but I will count their faith as their righteousness. Okay? Now, some of these people say faith is not a work, and that's how you say, it's by faith and not by works. But they make the argument that God looks at our faith and says, well, that's not righteousness, but I'll credit it to them as if it is righteousness. Okay? Now, that's not what I've been saying. If you've been tracking with me, I've been saying it's the righteousness of God, or specifically, as we'll see, of Christ, that's accounted to us. But Paul uses the language of the Old Testament, of Genesis 15, to make a very important point, which is that faith is absolutely crucial in this process. Okay, so before you deny a misunderstanding, you want to acknowledge that there is a point here. The reason Paul wrote it that way is to stress the central nature of faith in receiving righteousness. But if you actually read through the way Paul sets out his argument, you can see that it's not faith itself that's imputed to us. Look at verse 6. David describes the blessedness of the man to whom God imputes righteousness apart from works, not faith. Okay, so when Paul uses that language, he's emphasizing the importance of faith, but it's not, you might say, faith in itself, but it's the righteousness that is actually imputed to us. Okay, I don't particularly want to dwell on this point, but this is the point that the Arminians at the time of the Reformation, or post-Reformation, believed. This is what Richard Baxter, okay, good Puritan, great pastoral theology, got a little messed up on some of his other theologies. So Richard Baxter believed this, and the tendency was then to sneak in with faith all the other works. Okay, so God somehow lowers the standard of the law, so if you have faith and a faithful outworking of it, then God says, well, that'll be good enough for me, or something like that. That's not the way they said it. But there's a significant problem theologically with taking that understanding. Instead of dwelling on it further, let me recommend, another book. This is a book by John Piper, but not exactly in the style of books that Piper usually writes. This is Counted Righteous in Christ. Subtitled is a question, should we abandon the imputation of Christ's righteousness? So Piper is dealing with this controversy of within the last 10 years of a denial of the imputation of the righteousness of Christ, and one alternative, which is to take faith as what is imputed to us. And Piper does an excellent job of carefully explaining, which I'm not doing, what Paul is saying in these verses. I mean, you may think I'm doing it, but he goes through very carefully. You don't actually have to know the original language. He does a very good job of explaining in this passage and others both the fact that it's by imputation that we are made righteous, and that it's not our faith that's imputed, but the righteousness of Christ. So I recommend this book to you. The Westminster Confession, you may have noticed, I guess it was last week when I read it, specifically denies that faith is imputed to us for righteousness. It was one of the errors that was rejected. Okay, I'm not going any faster, am I? Okay, third point I've already made. Good. The imputation of righteousness is the same as justification. I already made that point. And the fourth point, and this is a connected with a very striking phrase in verse 5. To him who does not work but believes on him who justifies the ungodly. Okay, now, you know, that's terribly offensive, isn't it? And to say that God justifies the ungodly. And the ungodly is a very strong word. It means the one who refuses to worship God. It's really what the pagans, the Gentiles, were charged with back at the beginning of Paul's argument in Romans 1:18 and following. Right? They were ungodly. They refused to worship God. And Paul says, God is the one who justifies the ungodly. Now, he's not necessarily saying that Abraham was, you know, exactly in that condition, or that Abraham was just a rank pagan at the time of Genesis 15:6. But he's talking about the nature of our faith. And I've stressed this before, you know, faith has to have a content. It has to believe in a person, believes on him in verse 5. But you have to know something about who the person is. And what's the specific character of this person we believe in for justification? It is belief in, if you like, the God-who-justifies-the-ungodly. It's that sort of God. It's the God who justifies the ungodly that we believe in for salvation. So that suggests that part of the content of our faith has to be that we don't rest on our own works, but instead we believe in a specific kind of God, if you will. We believe in the true God who justifies the ungodly. I think I've mentioned before, I had a conversation in graduate school with a friend of mine who had a Jewish background, and we were talking about the gospel, and I opened my Bible and read verse 5 to him, and that was the end of the conversation for him. It cannot be that God justifies the ungodly. That's the offense of the gospel. I hope I wasn't being personally offensive at the time, but the offense of the gospel is you abandon all hope in your own works. You believe in a God who justifies the ungodly, and that's where your hope is. That's the nature of your faith. Okay, we're in the middle of a sentence here, not just my sentence, but Paul's sentence in verses 5 and 6, but I will catch my breath and you can ask a question or two. Any questions before we look at David in Psalm 32? Dave.
One of the reasons why this isn't an accounting gimmick, which is sometimes a phrase used to describe this position, why this doesn't represent Enron-style bookkeeping, is that righteousness was genuinely earned.
Right.
By someone. It is a real righteousness, not a theoretical one, or one that exists in the abstract. It is a genuine and real righteousness that came to the Father.
Right. Christ is righteous, and that's why the emphasis that Paul will actually give in Romans 5 on the obedience of Christ and the righteousness of Christ is crucial to his argument. And if I could say the other half of that is the fact it's not a legal fiction because we are joined to him, because he is our representative, and so his real righteousness is rightly credited to us for righteousness.
So in that sense, we are justified by works.
We are justified by the works of another. Yeah, that's right. Other comments or questions? Okay, so Paul, I think we can make it here. Paul then in verses 6 through 8 brings up David and Psalm 32 and emphasizes that David also describes the blessedness. Okay, so this is a great word. It's blessed to be in this condition, not to be trusting in your own righteousness, but to be the man to whom God imputes righteousness apart from works. So there's that sharp contrast. It's righteousness apart from works. It's righteousness by faith. And David describes the blessedness of this man in verses 7 and 8. So this is the first two verses of Psalm 32. Okay, we sing this fairly often. I'm going to try to get by not turning there, but I'll read it here. Blessed are those whose lawless deeds are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord shall not impute sin. Now you see that that word imputation appears in verse 8, or counting or crediting or whatever, but it's in the negative. It's like Shimei's example. The Lord will not impute sin to him. But Paul has said in verse 6 that David is describing the blessedness of the man to whom God imputes righteousness apart from works. Well, so is it righteousness that it's imputed, or is it sin that's not imputed? And the answer is yes, because it's both, right? And in a sense, you might say David is an even better example, because not only did David abandon hope in his own righteousness, but he pled with God not to credit his works with him. Not only did David say, don't reckon my works, or sorry, there are too many negatives if I say it a certain way. David didn't trust in his works and hope that God would impute them to him. Instead, David said, don't impute my works to me. So that's even a stronger thing. He wants to abandon all hope, that the Lord will not impute his sin to him. And so that's why Paul is able to bring in David as an example. This shows, by the way, that the imputation, that justification is a forensic, I use this word thing, it's not simply personal, or it's not personal transformation. David here is talking about forgiveness. So part of justification is forgiveness, which has obviously to do with our legal standing before God, not with our having a changed heart or changed behavior or infused righteousness. So forgiveness is the fact that he refers to forgiveness in the context of imputation and justification means that it has to do with our status before God and not our personal character, you might say. I talked about this before. That was part of the contention with the Roman Catholic Church, and still is. I would say that justification is not merely the forgiveness of sins. It is also positively the imputation of righteousness. But in future weeks, when we no doubt will have much more time, we will come back to that point, I think. So, let me make one other comment on Abraham, and David fits in well too here, just to reinforce this point. One of the errors that Paul had to contend with, this covenantal gnomism that actually the New Perspective says was the view of the Jews, that you're accepted with God by faith because of the covenant, because of his election, but then you're kept in your position by your own works and righteousness, and of course faith along with that. But what's striking, and what even Calvin points out, because this was something he had to contend with in the Roman Catholic controversies, is that both Abraham and David were not new believers. Did you ever think about that? Genesis 15:6 wasn't the beginning of Abraham's faith. Psalm 32 wasn't the beginning of David's faith. Okay? The point of quoting these mid-career statements, if you like, is that even those who are making progress in the Christian life still have to confess that all of their righteousness comes from another. It's not their righteousness. David pleads, don't impute my works to me. And Abraham was accepted as righteous because he trusted in another, because he believed the promises of God. So it's not just that you get in by faith, but you maintain your status by good works. It is by faith from first to last. It is, that's I think probably not what Paul means at the his use of the phrase, but it is always and only justification by faith alone. Okay. Not going to give you a chance to make comments. Last verses 9 through 12, Paul takes up circumcision. And again, you know, we may say, why does he harp on circumcision? It doesn't seem like that important a thing to us, but you have to have the Jewish mindset in which circumcision was the sign of the covenant, which is correct. Okay, that's Genesis 17:11, when God institutes circumcision for Abraham and his offspring. He calls it the sign of the covenant. But the Jewish error, the legalistic tendency, was to see circumcision as merely the first of a sequence of works of the law. by which we were accepted before God. Mixed with faith, of course, always acknowledging grace, but this mixture of faith and works. And so Paul, as he did at the end of chapter 3, so he has to come back again to this point, a point he came back to in chapter 2. And it is a significant thing. I've mentioned before the new perspectives, and they're, in essence, they're saying it's all about this circumcision versus uncircumcision. It's not all about that. It's about a personal standing before God. But it was a significant fact that Paul is saying circumcision is misunderstood by you. And he wants to explain how it's misunderstood by going back to Abraham. So verse 9, we say that faith was accounted to Abraham for righteousness. Okay, Genesis 15:6 again. I told you he was going to harp on that verse. Okay, and then he asks in verse 10, how then was it accounted? And his question is really, what was Abraham's status when he was accepted as righteous? Was it a circumcised status or an uncircumcised status? Okay. We may not think of circumcision as a status, you know, like nice cars or status or something like that. But if you were a Jew, you knew the Gentiles were uncircumcised, they were filthy, they were dogs, they were in that status, and you were circumcised. That was a different status to be in. So he's asking, okay, what was the status of Abraham when he was accepted as righteous before God? Okay, answer, Genesis 15 comes before Genesis 17. It's pretty easy. He was uncircumcised, okay? Genesis 17, which is, of course, after the verse he's been quoting repeatedly, was the account of the circumcision of Abraham. And that's what he says at the end of verse 10. He doesn't say 15 comes before 17, but he says, not while circumcised, but while uncircumcised. It's an obvious fact that Abraham had not been circumcised. He was still Abram, in fact, and, you know, that his name was changed later, but especially here the focus is on the status of being uncircumcised. So, what does that mean? Well, that means that circumcision is not necessary for justification, and it means that the works of the law which were tied in to circumcision are also not necessary for justification. I hope you see how crucial this is. You know, another important part of Paul's argument, because circumcision was looked to as the key indicator of someone who belonged to God as opposed to someone who didn't. And Abraham was accepted before God as righteous before he had that key indicator, if you want to call it that, before he had the badge of circumcision, as it's sometimes called these days. He was accepted as righteous before that. Now, the reference in verse 11 then to the seal, he received the sign of circumcision, the seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while still uncircumcised, underlines exactly that point. Okay, so a sign is different from a seal. A seal is something that is still used to authenticate. So if you have a diploma, there's, you know, some kind of a official seal on the diploma that says that the person actually earned this degree. Okay, the seal doesn't create the degree, in a sense, right? I mean, it's not as if it somehow, poof, you've done all the work once they put the seal on there, but it is an authentication that you have earned this degree. So in the same way, although not with earning, the same way Paul says that the sign of that circumcision, which was a sign, was also a seal of the righteousness of faith he had while uncircumcised. Okay, and then his point for the immediate argument would be, if it's a seal of something, it must come after it, right? You don't get the seal of righteousness until you have righteousness. The seal of circumcision came after the fact of the acceptance of him as righteous, because Genesis 17 comes after Genesis 15, a period of several years in between the two, in fact. But that's the specific point there. That circumcision was a seal of the righteousness of the faith that he had while he was uncircumcised. So I want to come back to that point, but let me just try to wrap up his argument here. So then Paul draws out in the last part of verse 11 and in verse 12 what that means for us. So first referring to us as Gentiles, that's a fair assumption. That is, that we also might have Abraham as our father. Because we are uncircumcised in the sense that we're not part of the that system that was instituted with circumcision and the whole connection that it would make. He's talking about circumcision as a ritual act here. He's saying that because Abraham was accepted as righteous before he was circumcised, we too, who are uncircumcised, can be accepted as righteous. In verse 11, that righteousness might be imputed to them also. Same phrase over again, okay, that we might be accepted the way Abraham was. He is our father. Okay, so he began the chapter referring to Abraham, our forefather according to the flesh. And now he says, for every Gentile who believes, Abraham is truly their father, because they walk in the same steps of faith, as he will say, as Abraham did. And in verse 12, he says also, he is the father to those who are circumcised, as long as they walk in the same steps of faith that he had. So I think his argument is fairly clear here, right? It is simply the fact that Abraham, the founder, you might say, of their religion, the father, according to the flesh, was in fact not received as righteous because, or in any way, because of his circumcision, but rather the circumcision confirmed the righteousness that he already had. Now, okay, I have a couple of minutes left. Let me make just a little, I always say that and it doesn't work, but let me make just a few comments on the righteousness, the seal of the righteousness of faith that circumcision is. This shows, first of all, that circumcision wasn't just a badge of racial identity. Okay, some people, okay, this comes up in a polemic context. Okay, it comes up when Presbyterians and those who believe in infant baptism are arguing with Baptists, those who believe in baptism of those who profess faith. And sometimes people, the Baptist side, will say, well, circumcision was a sign of racial identity. Okay, you were marked out as a Jew because you were circumcised. Well, that's not what Paul says here, and nor is it specifically connected with the receiving of the land. Okay, now I'm not denying that that was part of the Abrahamic covenant, but I'm saying if you look at what Paul here uses to characterize circumcision, it doesn't say anything about the land. Actually, later on in the chapter he will, and he applies it to the whole world. Okay, so it's a little twist there. But it is instead the fact that circumcision is about spiritual matters. It's about our acceptance with God. It's not, doesn't affect that acceptance with God, doesn't bring it about, but it is a seal of that acceptance with God. So what he's saying, in effect, is that if Abraham ever doubted whether he was accepted with God, he could think of his circumcision. The circumcision was for him like that seal on the diploma. It was God's assurance to him that because he had and did believe in God, he was accepted as righteous. It's a tremendous gift that God gives us assurances like that. And obviously you see where I could go here, but I'm not going to. Baptism functions in the same way. In fact, the Reformed have argued that the sacraments function in the same way as signs of the covenant and also seals. And God is very kind to us. We might say we don't need seals until we need them, and then we wish we had them. And God has already provided many things for us. But in particular, the circumcision was a mark in Abraham's flesh so that he would never forget that God had taken him as his own, not for his own righteousness, but because by faith he believed in the one to come. And that's a very significant statement about circumcision. Paul has had a lot of negative things to say about circumcision. I made this point way back in chapter 2. You have to understand the context. When Paul says a lot of negative things about circumcision, he's not saying that there are no positive things. Much in every way, he says at the beginning of chapter 3, you know, circumcision is a great privilege, and this is one aspect of that that is particularly important and relevant to us. Because, as Paul argues elsewhere, circumcision and baptism have equivalent functions within the covenant, the same significance in the sense of what they're pointing to. Well, I guess we could take some time to justify that, no pun intended, but I'm going to have to stop there. Any comments or questions on that bit, or I suppose the whole thing? can't believe we covered all that. I think I talked too fast. Any comments? Okay. Well, let's close in prayer.